everyone, and welcome to Stutter Talk. I'm Chaya Goldstein, speech language pathologist and person who stutters, here with Sam Simpson, one of the editors and contributors of the Stammering, Pride, and Prejudice book. This episode is part of an ongoing series which delves into the book and looks closely at the social model of disability. Today, we will be discussing Sam's thoughts on the book, and specifically her chapter titled Looking Back, Looking Forward. Sam Simpson is a speech and language therapist with over 25 years of experience of working with people who stammer and their families in the public, private, education, and voluntary sectors. She is also a person-centered counselor who runs her private practice just outside London. She co-edited the book Stammering Therapy From the Inside with Rachel Everard and Carolyn Chesman, and most recently co-edited Stammering, Pride, and Prejudice, Difference Not Defect with Patrick Campbell and Chris Constantino, the book we will be discussing today. Sam, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So Stammering, Pride, and Prejudice, it challenges the narrative of the medical model of disability, often in which we look at stuttering at and through. And it dives deep into exploring stuttering through the social model of disability. So I want to dig in and hear your perspective on it as one of the editors and also as an author of a chapter. So let's start with it. Can you summarize what is the book about, and specifically why did you feel it was important to write?
Yeah, the book, I suppose what the origins of the book were really based in the fact that Patrick, Chris, and I had shared frustrations about the thin and negative understandings of stammering that exist in today's society and that are most commonly represented really in the media and in the literature. And we really wanted to challenge the taken for granted assumptions that stammering is inferior to fluency, and its kind of historical position as the negative opposite of fluency. So I suppose the book, it's political in the sense that we wanted to chronicle the attitudinal and environmental and structural barriers that exist in society and that are experienced by people who stammer on a day-to-day basis. And we also wanted to offer some different, some alternative ways of thinking and talking about stammering and to celebrate these positive ways of understanding stammering in all in one text. So it was an ambitious project, but we wanted to, capture all of those elements in a very accessible text that wasn't just for a professional audience, but that was for people who stammer as well as the general public at large.
Mm-hmm. And how did you go about, because I haven't asked this of Chris or Patrick yet, how did you go about getting the authors for your book?
I mean, it was quite an organic process, really. We met a number of times via Skype because we're in different parts of not only the UK but the world, and started to, I guess, pull together names and people that we'd heard or read talking about stammering from different perspectives, or who we knew or we'd heard present at conferences. And so we started to kind of compile a list, and we really wanted voices across the world to represent different perspectives, and then I suppose once we'd compiled that list, we just approached people to see if they would be interested in writing something or producing some artwork or poetry or contributing in any way that they wanted. And the large majority were really interested in the idea of the book and willing to contribute. Some needed a little bit more persuasion and encouragement than others. But some just could not meet the deadline or just had other commitments at the time. But then it was a process of kind of setting deadlines and inviting people to contribute by those deadlines. And that also, you know, some people were more able to do that due to their other commitments than others. So there were some losses, I guess, along the way. But probably 85% of the people we originally approached are represented in the book, which is great.
Yeah, that is great, because you have such a great mix of voices and experiences. So I think you did an incredible job. I want to hear from you, Sam, as someone who does not stutter, but is a speech therapist working with stuttering for all these years, what did you see was lacking within the therapy and the way that we, I'm a speech therapist too, were being taught in that you said, no, we need to look at this through a different lens, namely the social model?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the foundations of speech and language therapy are very much based in the medical model. And when I was training, that was very much the lens through which I was being taught. I was viewing communication difference more generally and stammering more specifically. And, you know, I suppose the focus then of my role, the approach to therapy was very much informed by looking at stammering as a deficit and something then that needed some form of remediation, if you like. And I think I was introduced by one of my tutors at City Lit to a book called Mustn't Grumble, which is a compilation of chapters and poems by disabled women writers. And that really opened my eyes to a different way of conceptualizing difference and introduced me to the principles of the social model. And I think that it was revelatory, really, because it just opened my eyes to a different way of conceptualizing difference, and that actually the kind of narrow frame really of just viewing difference as defect and this kind of binary normal abnormal, this binary two-dimensional view really of difference. And I think the social model just it's rather than seeing communication differences in black and white, I think it kind of it opens up this rainbow of colours, this kind of whole different, I don't know, prism or spectrum of different colours and textures and ways of viewing difference that I think is just far more engaging and dynamic and three-dimensional. I think it's critical really as a profession that we broaden our perspective and understanding of communication differences more generally and stammering as we're talking about at the moment more specifically.
There is a quote that stood out to me, and I'd love if you spoke to it. And in the quote you write, the clearly articulated and angry stories of oppression and exclusion taught me that from a social model perspective, people aren't disabled because they have an impaired body, mind, or means of communication, but because society places structural, environmental, and attitudinal barriers in the way. So can you speak to the barriers that are put in the way, be it structural, environmental, and attitudinal, as you laid out here in this quote?
Yeah, I think, I mean, what that speaks to me is rather than viewing stammering as a medical or therapeutic issue, if you like, I think it broadens the focus and views difference or disability as almost a civil rights and justice issue. It shifts the focus away from the actual stammering or the individual who stammers and looks much more contextually Josh and Pierre always talked about how it takes two people to stammer. And I think that in itself is, you know, stammering doesn't happen in a vacuum. You need to look at the context. And I think when we look at today's society, we live in a society that is focused on excellence, focused on achievement, and is very fast paced. And I think it brings expectations and norms and values around productivity and efficiency that we are all prey to. But I think that is particularly important for stammering, because it not only kind of fosters this fluency, the importance of fluency, or the value of fluency, or the worship of fluency, but it creates this kind of sense of time pressure. I think the internalization of these values and these norms can become very self-stigmatizing, really. And that creates an interesting dynamic, I think. And again, helps us locate where the problem, if you see a problem of around stammering, where you locate the problem to be, away from the individual and really looking at the values and attitudes in society, and how those are experienced by people who stammer. And I think it then opens up where therapy might have a role, or where change needs to take place, in terms of really raising awareness of these norms and values and expectations within society, and challenging and questioning them.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that society, even putting stammering aside, society places tremendous value on excellence and perfection. And
I think so. I think we're all living these lives in a permanent state of upgrade, aren't we? But we feel like we need, I don't know, this whole self-improvement culture and feeling, yeah, the need to conform to these values.
So I wonder, is this about stuttering exclusively, or is this a broader issue?
I think that is a broader issue. And I think that's what's interesting, you know, from a social model perspective, is it helps shine a lens really on these values within society that I think are insidious. We don't really kind of see them or notice them. We grow up in them through education. You know, it's always about sort of getting the grades, high achievement, that the kind of stickers for excellent performance, and that goes through education into work, into our New Year's goals every year. I think it's a much broader issue and cultural narrative that stammering, I think, really helps shine a lens on and helps us see that much more clearly.
Fascinating. Yeah, this is the first time that I'm seeing this conversation in a new light, whereas when I've discussed the social model as it relates to stuttering, sometimes it seemed to almost point fingers on quote-unquote society, as in them needing to make space. But what I'm really seeing and hearing from this conversation so far is that it's almost stuttering is an opportunity for society to hold up a mirror, to slow down and to question this endless running of excellence and perfectionism. And in doing that, as a result, stuttering and other differences will have more space. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Interesting. Really, really interesting. So when was the first time you came across the social model of disability?
So in 1995, when I read Mustn't Grumble, and then I, you know, from there I devoured that. There was a lot of writing in the 1990s over here. Michael Oliver, Vic Finkelstein, Tom Shakespeare. It was a really kind of dynamic time, I think, where lots of people were writing and challenging the medical model and offering a different critique. And I think at that point in my career, my career has always straddled stammering and brain injury. And there were a number of eminent aphasiologists over in the UK who really embraced these ideas and hugely influenced how services for people with aphasia were set up. And I think, you know, then it became an intrinsic way of how we as a community worked and spoke and set up services and worked collaboratively with people with aphasia. You know, if I think back to those times, you know, there were poetry workshops, for example, and really encouraging people with aphasia to explore their new language and the creativity of that language and the nuance of that language. And I was really intrigued by how just the absence of that engagement with the social model within within stammering therapy and trainings and conferences at that time. And I suppose, you know, that led me to write articles. I wrote an article with Carolyn Chesman in 1999. And then when I came back sort of post my family to start giving presentations at various conferences with Katie Bailey and St. John Harris, and then to combine with Carolyn and Rachel Everard at City Lit, to try and just engage the profession more broadly with some of these ideas.
So you're saying that in 1999 there was engagement with the social model and the communities that worked with RAIN injuries or differences really picked it up and ran with it, like aphasia did traumatic brain injury as well, put their focus there.
I think that, you know, there were key people really within the field of aphasia, Carol Pound, Susie Parr, Sally Bing, that really influenced thinking and were just very quick to lobby to start, you know, really influencing policy really and service delivery. So they thought really big, and you know, I can see parallels. I think if you look within learning disability, or certainly within the deaf community, you know, I think again there were parallel changes and engagement, and yet it wasn't happening within stammering therapy and the stammering therapy community in the same way. And it's interesting to think why, you know, why was it not happening? You know, maybe in part because there was a reluctance to engage with the disability movement to, you know, it's contentious to be, although stammering is recognized, as you know, in terms of disability legislation, I think it is more contentious in terms of people's willingness to identify as disabled, and you know, maybe also something about the dynamic of stammering, that for some people it's not consistent and therefore you know, people maybe are more hesitant to then consider that themselves disabled. But if you think about it in the context of the social model, you know, irrespective of the stammering, I suppose when you look at attitudinal barriers, when you look at the sort of discriminatory attitudes or stereotypical views and understandings of stammering that might influence job interviews, for example, or might interview career development, that is disabling potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely hear that there has been a reluctance for it to be picked up, and perhaps not wanting to be labeled as disabled, even though real life experiences prove that
it is similar to other people with other disabilities, that those same outcomes are happening. So why are we so reluctant to join that rank? But back to
cultural and attitudinal environmental barriers exist, don't they? Really, that they're kind of out there, and you know, I think in many ways, the social model can be quite empowering because it can give you a framework and a language to really think about barriers and to think about prejudice and stigma and to really engage with that in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And so from 1999 until today, well, until the book was written, is 2019. So you had 20 years go by. Was there any pickup along the way, or has it been, we were in the dark ages and only more recently did we pick it up?
Well, I think, I mean, maybe at the time, you know, in the 90, if I think of the article I wrote with Carolyn Chesman in 99, I wonder whether, you know, maybe the soil, the kind of climate, it wasn't the right time. You know, maybe it's almost, it needed 20 years for the seeds to take root and start to shoot and germinate. And I suppose there's been a lot of change, hasn't there, culturally? If you think of, if we think of positive psychology, if we think of the strengths movement, if we think of neurodiversity and I don't know how we conceptualize sexuality and gender, we're moving away from these kind of binary conceptualizations to something that is more multidimensional and nuanced. And maybe, you know, that the climate now is one of embracing difference. If we think of diversity and inclusiveness within employment, for example, the soil and the climate is very different.
And back to what you were saying before about the benefits of allowing oneself to say, yes, stammering is a disability, looking at this through the social model and looking at the barriers externally, can you speak to what some of those benefits are?
Well, I think, I mean, when I say, you know, when I talk about disability, I suppose I'm thinking very much about framing it from the social model of disability. So that really is locating disability in society and in those structural, environmental and attitudinal barriers. I think if you can conceptualize disability as not individual, then that shifts an understanding of, you know, that the problem resides with me, to actually the issues are external to me. And that means, you know, I think that can be quite empowering in terms of then creating environments that are more stammer friendly. So, if we think about, in education, for example, I mean, I think Mary Weidner is doing some great work looking at the attitudinal change and tolerance program. So really looking at going into schools and running educational programs for young children around difference, and really she creatively uses puppets and narratives through puppets that really helps young people understand that everybody is different. And valuing the uniqueness of different ethnicities, different speech differences, different physical abilities, and physical appearances, and so fostering that understanding and changing those attitudes and values really around difference. Fast forward to university, I suppose, being able to create a stammer-friendly environment might involve disclosing stammering and negotiating, giving presentations just to your tutor or in a small group or via video or recording, yeah, and then playing it. So being able to request reasonable adjustments that are going to support that environment for you. Similarly, I don't know, fast forward to adults looking for employment, then being able to sort of shape how an interview might go, or really look at how, in terms of meetings, how meetings are organized in order for everybody in that meeting to be able to contribute. I can think of working with somebody who opened up a dialogue in a meeting at work about how competitive it was, and how everybody spoke over everybody else, and how that made it very difficult for him to contribute as a person who stammers. And actually that really raised awareness of how poorly everyone was listening to each other, how it was the person who spoke the loudest in many ways who often got heard, and whose voices were not being represented, and whose views were not then being listened to. And I think they were then able to really think about the culture of those meetings and how to make them much more inclusive and to really benefit from the perspectives of everybody. So I think it helps to shift where the change needs to be.
Yeah, so the change, it sounds like it's no longer saying you, person who stutters, stammers, must make all the changes. There are changes that can be made in the environment. But the nice thing about what you're saying is that it's not either taking the responsibility and completely placing it on all external factors. I would even argue that would be almost handing over your locus of control and choice, but it's this healthy conversation, this exchange that goes between the person who stutters and the people in their environment, which includes education, conversation, and genuine listening and interest on both parts. Would you say that's correct?
Absolutely. You know, I think that's how we can all learn, and we can all benefit from those dialogues. And we can all benefit from, again, it's back to what stammering shines a light on, really, within communication, within a work culture. What it can really highlight, and what we can all learn from and gain insight to and create change around, really. And I think that can be of benefit to the person who stammers, and it can be of benefit to everybody who works with them who doesn't stammer, or other people with other differences within that community.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I say that because I have heard conversation and sometimes pushback to the social model of disability, saying that placing all responsibility externally doesn't benefit anyone. Meaning, how is someone supposed to know what to do when they're speaking with someone who stutter? And doesn't a person who stutter want to take some of the responsibility for themselves? And so the way that you're describing it, though, it sounds like a really growth-oriented process for everyone. Yeah, fascinating. Wonderful. Now, looking back and looking forward, so if you were to summarize, what have you learned looking back, and what are your hopes looking forward? What would you say?
I think the social model, I suppose what it's really shined a light on for me is how the narrow focus of any restorative therapy really only serves to reinforce and reaffirm the social norms and stigma that exists in society, and doesn't really give us an opportunity to challenge those prevailing norms. And I think, I've learned that if we can position stammering and stammering, the stammering therapy discourse within the broader disability discourse, then that offers us a means of really revising and extending the boundaries of how we think about stammering and about therapy. I think what the social model has offered me is an opportunity to really think about my attitudes and my beliefs and assumptions about difference and about disability and how these have been shaped over time. And it's really helped me look at my personal motives for the work that I do and my philosophy of therapy. I think it's been really informing. And I think, you know, looking the work with Chris and Patrick and really looking at the concept of stammering gain, I think, you know, again, it shines a light on the power of words, on the subtlety of language, on the importance of really listening fully to what someone's saying and those delicate shifts in any interaction. The different qualities of silence, and how compelling kind of vulnerability and intimacy it is in interactions. And so again, what stammering can really shine a light on. And I suppose going forward, more discussions of this, really more what would I like to see? Just more people writing about stammering, different perspectives, and understandings of stammering and what the uniqueness of stammering and the experience of stammering brings, really, and how that can be a benefit not only to the community of people who stammer, but to, as I said before, society in general. And then I suppose in terms of therapy, I think what I would really love to see are all the educators, all the therapists working in at universities, really integrating the diversity agenda into speech and language therapy training, so that future therapists can really consider their sort of philosophy of therapy and their role in today's society. And I think we need more platforms. I'm involved at the moment in running some courses with Patrick Campbell that are bringing people who stammer and therapists together as co-participants on training, so that we can really open up dialogue really about the underlying values and role and scope of practice. And I think that kind of meaningful collaboration and dialogue is going to be really important going forward.
So really having, you're saying, from a top down approach, having educators within the universities have the next generation of therapists understand the social model so that they can better support their clients as they meet the world with their stutter.
Absolutely. You know, for me, I was just lucky that someone recommended a book. It wasn't integrated into my training program. And I think that's what I would really like to see. For there to be a real debate, and this maybe extends beyond stammering therapy, really, but a debate within speech and language therapy, more generally, really, about our role and underlying values going forward.
I think that's a big conversation that is important and definitely can be had across a lot of the modalities, not just stuttering. So at the end of your chapter, you say such a voyage calls for action on many levels, and you list having educators integrate the diversity agenda, having current therapists re-examine their underlying values, their role and scope of practice, having more researchers willing to consider alternative conceptual frameworks to the medical model for future stuttering research, having widespread research into public awareness campaigns that tackle stigma and stereotypes, in addition to the development and coordination of robust information, education, and support programs of schools, universities, and places of work, as well as public services. So you actually really lay out in your chapter at the end some practical, small, and then global
visions for what can be done. So if anyone's listening to this episode and has this interest, be it on a small level or maybe a professor on a grander scale, or maybe an activist or an advocate, what would you want to tell them?
What would I want to tell them? I suppose what would I want to tell them is there's something about, I mean, I guess it's that adage, isn't it? Be the change you want to see. It's really having conversations, really, and bringing people together, looking at where is your circle of influence. So be that, I don't know, different chapters or support groups really getting together and thinking about how they can, or the changes they would like to see as a group and how they can bring those about within their local community. Or it may be, I don't know, speech and language therapy students on a course just coming together and really critiquing their program and course through a social model lens. I mean, there's something about starting with yourself, isn't there? There's something about getting informed and opening your own eyes, maybe reading, setting up conversations with different people, and then looking at how that's going to translate into action.
Yeah. And really a great place to start is making a plug for your book, Stamming Pride and Prejudice, Difference Not Defect. I really think you cover such a wide variety of the social model and the experiences in which people live, have and do live their lives and can speak to it. So I would add to that, if you can, get a hold of this book. It's really wonderful.
That's very kind. Yeah.
All right. So we're going to wrap up. Any final thoughts that you have before we bring the conversation to an end?
I think there's something about getting curious. There's something about really getting curious and really being willing to question yourself and your own understanding and your own perspective, and you know, listening out to language, listening out just the kind of norms that are out there. I think once you start reading or thinking or kind of questioning, you can start seeing these attitudes and values are out there in the world, and I think then we can start we can really start dismantling them and untangling them and opening up some different dialogue. So I guess my invitation is to get curious, to really try and give these ideas some serious thought and open up some dialogues. Plug for the book, that maybe that is a place to start in terms of doing some thinking and some internal work.
Beautiful. Yes. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with me today, Sam. And thank you for that invitation to get curious, to listen, and to question and then create dialogue. I think those are such great takeaways from this conversation. So with that, we're going to end our podcast for tonight. Thanks again, Sam, and have a great evening.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.